Hello and welcome to the MITI podcast.
We are a small but dedicated group with a vision for agroecology and the culture
around agriculture.
My name is Anurag.
And my name is Lotus.
There have been simpler times with people who shared a vision similar to ours. The MITI Collective, as opportunists of the internet generation, considered themselves humbled by these people who did much more with so much lesser. We are spoiled with options and resources as a generation, and it becomes all the more a necessity to use it for a better future. Through our humble podcast, we hope to disseminate valuable knowledge while engaging with people who are already adopting an alternative lifestyle. In today's podcast, we talk with Andrea, a close friend who was also our guest blogger for the article Humble MITI Hugel. The blog has received much appreciation for its lighthearted but impactful message on how one individual can change a lot.
Welcome, Andrea. It's a pleasure to have you today.
Hi, Anurag, and hi, Lotus. Thank you for inviting me.
How are you feeling?
I feel nervous, but also I feel very happy to be here sharing a time with you.
We are also really, really happy, Andrea. And first of all, thank you for such an amazing blog post. Everyone listening, guys, you have to read this blog post. It's amazing. Andrea simply gives us a slice of her everyday life, and it's such a warm and passionate life she's leading right now. So how about you tell us a little bit about yourself first?
Well, so my name is Andrea, and I'm from the north of Spain. For those of you who think Spain is just like sunny and flat, well, in the north, we struggle to have warm sunny days. Yeah, but that's also a privilege for the agriculture, because we have a special landscape. It's like similar to northern India and or south of Nepal. But of course the climate is slightly different, but it's hilly. There are mountains as well. We have sea line. It's very beautiful as well, and we have a lot of rains, and it makes it slightly different from the other parts of Spain. So I'm from a small village in the region of Asturias, and I'm from a family who has traditionally worked the land and also had some farm. My mom, she's a farmer. And, well, my father also helps out in the farm.
And how about your family? You said that you have really strong relation to the countryside and the land around you.
Well, the thing is that I spent all my childhood holidays with my family, helping them out in the land. Well, helping or disturbing, because when you are a child, you know, you play more than... I didn't work. I was not exploited. That's a good thing. But, yeah, I lived it as normal, you know. We worked collectively in the land. And so every season we had different tasks to do. And so, I don't know. For me, it was natural. But the thing is that, when I was growing up, like, this lifestyle, I could say, it was going extinct, you know. And for me, it was always a dream to be able to continue this tradition. But sometimes I feel that because of being born a woman, I was not encouraged. I was discouraged to pursue or to do these practices.
So, but Andrea, can you like give us a background of what you have been up to until now? and how come you came back to this practice and how you intend to continue it.
Also, it's a good idea to know about your travels. You're a really good traveler, aren't you?
Well, I'm a geographer, but my profession is a geographer. So one of my tasks is to go around and explore and that. But actually, before getting officially geographer, I was explorer. So yeah, the thing is that since I was, I think, teenager or something, I wanted to do this thing I'm doing now in very small scale, but I wanted, you know, helping my grandfather with the garden on the farm. Not so much the animals because, well, we will talk later if you want about animals in my culture because it's very meat-based. And but I had interest in everything with agricultural plants or things like that. So, yeah, I studied in many places, but when I was studying in Asturias, I was living with my parents. That's a very typical thing in Spain when you are young and you study. So I was helping out my grandfather, but I wanted to do more. I wanted to do my own gardening, my own practices. But then when I finished my studies, I started working, and the way the Spanish system, the working schedule is based, is simply the whole day, you know, from 8 to 8. So you don't have time for anything, just for this work. So the land, I only had some time for doing maybe weekends or something like that. But it's not easy. It's, the land needs you to be there and do every day a little bit. But the problem got worse because I work in the city, of course, and there's no jobs in the village. And then I moved to the city, and it was very hard to, was nearly impossible to be in the farm or in the garden. And after a few years in the city, even though it's a medium-sized city, it's really a ridiculous city, but I was not happy. So I quit my job and I went to Ireland to do organic farming or agriculture, and it was great. So after that experience of volunteering there, I moved to Norway to learn more about biodynamic gardening. And yeah, since then I've been actually practicing agriculture as a, well, not hobby, but I don't know how to call it, just volunteering or engaging in any type of collective practice to do with environmental protection, sustainability, and self-sufficiency. So then after 4 years doing this type of volunteering between Ireland and Norway, I decided to study this geography, which was really amazing experience. And also I was so fortunate to find this group of people in Trondheim, with who we started the first urban garden in the region in the middle of Norway. And it was amazing. Really, I felt so connected to this land, even though it's not my country, it's not my culture, but I felt this connection or this relationship I couldn't establish with my own land, you know. And so everywhere I travel, I don't know, I find a garden. I don't know why. In Thailand, I went for my master's thesis fieldwork, and also they started a garden there with some students' associations. Then I've just been to France as Erasmus, and in my neighborhood there was a permaculture garden, so I feel like the garden is everywhere I go. Wow. So when I came back, actually, as I told you, maybe it's like now 20 years I'm trying to do this small farming, gardening in my village. But now I feel like now I must, you know, it's a must. It's something I was not able to do because of many things, not only work or social difficulties, but there are many factors. But I said like, okay, this is priority this year, first year. like start of the year, let's do this. And I did. It was not easy. Like the practical works, it was hard, but the hardest part is the lack of support and all these things. But yeah, like I think it has made such a big impact in people, you know, like people see this and I don't know, they change really. Like I saw myself, like when I was in this garden in Norway, we had this teacher, like permaculture teacher, and we had this practical workshop during the weekend, and I couldn't believe my eyes with this technique. So, and then we didn't do anything. Then next autumn, they were there. I was like, this is not possible. I have to do this. So that was my dream, like to reproduce that type of technique in my grandfather's piece of land. But of course, my grandfather, he has his own techniques, and he was like, no, but you cannot do like that. You have to do this and this. I was like, let me do as I know. But, so I had to wait until my grandfather was really old that he couldn't go to the garden himself. And then it's sad, but it's the reality. So the garden was abandoned, and then I asked him, like, can I use that? And he said, yes, of course, I will be so happy. I was like, okay, now everyone is happy, you know, we have this. And even my father, he for the first time in his life, he's like asking me, like, oh, Andrea, I've been thinking a lot about having an own garden, own kitchen garden. Would you like to do it with me? I'm like, okay. This is new for me.
Yeah. At last, support comes along then.
No, I wouldn't call it support, because they still want you to do it. You know, like, you have to dig the land, you have to do this. I'm like, no. But yeah, but at least they see agriculture with different eyes, because originally the region is so poor that they do for a survival, and for them it's so natural, this relationship with the land, because they are dependent on the land. And we all are. But I think the problem comes when the people does not understand this dependency we have on nature and lands, you know. We think that we get everything from, I don't know, but the reality is that nature can survive with us very well. Like we can see during the confinement, we were all in the houses and the nature was blooming and producing and is never stopping. But us, we do need the nature and the her or his generosity, yes, for survival.
Yeah, definitely.
In the blog that you submitted to us, which was so amazing, again, I can't stop admiring it. There is this thing that you mentioned about the Spanish Machista culture. And it's so interesting, because to our average listeners, I think they would relate to it. But can you explain more about that?
I can provide some examples. I don't know if you are interested in listening to examples.
For sure.
Examples are okay. Always a good idea.
Because, like, I am a person, like, I don't know, sometimes I don't understand the things. But because for me it was always strange, like, why I'm not allowed to do certain things and why I'm forced to do other things. So growing up in this type of family, it was not easy, because yeah, it's very gender based, like the gender gap is very strong. So women, they have to do homework, and men, they do other jobs. So I wanted to do gardening or farming, things like that, because I loved it. But they didn't allow me. So, and at the same time, I was forced, kind of forced, not forced, because I said, no, I don't want, but then it was complete, to do the housework for the males in the family. And like, I was like, why should I don't know. I love cooking, so I can cook for everyone. That's not a problem. But why should I do tasks that the person himself is not doing, you know? Like, I don't know, cleaning his room or things like that. It's like, no, I'm not cleaning mine. I'm not cleaning others, you know. But for instance, like we had some animals and I always saw my grandfather like cutting the grass for and giving the fresh grass to rabbits. So that was one of my dreams, you know, I think for many years, decades, I was asking my grandfather, like, oh, grandfather, you have to teach me to cut, I call it cut grass for rabbits. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yes, yes, but never happened. Still today, they never would teach me, they would never allow me to use this tool, you know, it's dangerous tool for a woman. But actually, I'm using it without knowing I'm using it. And even in Norway, I was using it. And just by observing the males in my family doing certain tasks, I think I learned the know-how somehow, not the practice, but just the technique, just by observing. So those things, you know, they don't want to teach me. And it is tradition. It is the traditional knowledge. And if they don't teach it to other generations, this will be lost. And they don't teach it to women. That is so simple.
When you were working in Norway as a volunteer, was it a farm that somebody owned? And whether the owners were of an older generation, was it the case there?
No. It was a collective, like kind of eco-village.
Mm-hmm.
We had a professional gardener from the Netherlands. I admire them so much. They are just like the best ever. They are professionally trained there in the Netherlands into biodynamic farming.
Mm-hmm.
And so this person was responsible for the production.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was actually divided into agriculture and farming. And I was interested just in agriculture. So the gardener, he has the plan, and then the volunteers, we do the work in collaboration with him or her. And it was amazing. Like, the results I saw in this Norwegian garden, like, in Norway, the climate is just so bad, you know. Like, one of the reasons I left Norway is because there's only one season for the garden. Yeah, and then winter, there's nothing. And here they were able to produce for the whole year, like preserving the vegetables in a good way. They will last the whole winter. I was very impressed. So
it's funny that in a country like Norway, where they only have one season, they are trying to practice alternatives, whereas in a country like Spain, where there is an abundance of options, they are not ready to change. They continue with a certain variety of cropping system.
Yes, it is very interesting, your point, Anurag. And I think it's just it's a political decision. Since it's so simple as that. And in Norway, even though they also have the standard practices, like industrial practices. Mm-hmm. But it is more, the political system is more local based. So the municipality has quite a lot of responsibility, power, and mm-hmm. also the regions, mm-hmm. the collaboration, the intercommunality, I don't know how to say it. And also in Norway, they provide like this space for the new things, you know, like they are not so strict, like they allow people to do things differently if they want and at so many levels of her or his lives, you know, so they can perform some practices that in other countries are not legal, for instance. But yeah, then for instance, in Norway, one thing that surprised me really a lot is on the regional level, they have so much interest into this type of sustainable alternative practices of land. And here would be just consider like, oh, this group of people, they are freaks, or, you know, they are activists, or, oh, these people are troublemakers, you know, because they want different things. In Spain, it would be like that, but in Norway, it would be like, it works. Okay, it's good for the planet. Yeah, so why not? So they have kind of common sense that I think in other countries they lack somehow. But I also think that it is like, for instance, my region, Asturias, now in the during the confinement, we can really appreciate. Even though you live in a city, you always come from a village. You have family in the village. And you remember, it's just a matter of fact. You have to leave the village to find a job in whatever you study. Because in the villages, there are no jobs. Mm. That's the reality. And in Norway, it's very rural country somehow. The cities are small and very green. And everyone has kind of rural roots. So for them, it's natural. But if you go to the mega cities, like, for instance, even in our capital city here, there are generations of people who have lived in the city, even though it's small or medium, and they don't have this root with the village. So they consider the village as unclean, you know, unpure, like, oh, it smells bad, or things like that, without considering and admitting that you are dependent on this. Mm-hmm. You are not growing the food in the cities. So the cities depend on the villages. Well, now more and more they are urban farms and urban gardens.
Mm.
But yeah, they consider it unclean. They consider the peasant an ignorant because there were no schools in the villages. It was very hard for a farmer or a peasant to access education, especially higher education, because if it's not available for all, then it gets like an exclusive thing. So education is not, for them, it's not a right. It's just a privilege, you know. But in Norway, the system also is, for Norwegians, education is a right. So everyone has access to higher education. Everyone, single everyone. Mm-hmm. It was so funny when this couple won the Nobel Prize in medicine, you know. Mm-hmm. It was so beautiful because these people are from villages. These people are from villages in Norway. So they mm-hmm. were like, we are so privileged here because we, being from a village, we have won a Nobel Prize in medicine, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. I love that. I really love Norway because they are so like giving opportunities to people just to develop themselves, you know. But in other countries, it's not like that. It's like my potatoes in my later post. And I want to make a comparison. It's a metaphor. Imagine we're low potatoes. We have a potential to produce more small potatoes because I found out that potato is a thing of being. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but it can reproduce and create new lives. So, of course, men are reproductive, but in a different sense. So when I saw this potato with the baby potatoes there, I was like, oh, it's a female. Okay. The thing is that if you provide this potato a good soil and a good environment, no a lot of work, no a lot of constraints, but just leave it and give some care and love, the potato will reproduce and give as a result amazing potatoes, like the one we got in France, because I just plant some potatoes there in March, mid-March, before the confinement. 2 months after, they're huge and you can eat them. It's like, wow, I did nothing. I did 1 hour work. We did nothing, not even watering them, you know. And now they are amazing. But if you don't give this potato a proper space, like I left my potatoes here, trusting when I come back, I can eat them. And what I found, to my surprise, is they have reproduced. Now they are small babies. I'm like, I cannot eat you now. You know, you have small babies. But I thought that I could be eating them, but I cannot because the mother has become old potato. I cannot eat that potato. And the small ones, they're so small. And they're so small because they just reproduce in a plastic bag together with other potatoes and nothing, you know. So it's like people. If you have people in paper bags or, sorry, not paper, plastic bags or, well, in paper bags as well. If you have people repressed, they cannot develop their potential. They cannot be useful to society. But if you have people in good conditions, they can be very good for society and make contribution. So I think people like us in Spain are like in a plastic bag. We are a weird thing. We must be control, you know. We cannot be like in free. We cannot be, well, now the trends are changing. But yeah, for me, it's a metaphor, like about people, potential, and, but also the, in the end, it's just for the benefit of society.
Mm-hmm. But you know, I like this metaphor very much. If we apply it to agriculture, though, do you think this confinement, this limitation, as you as you simulated it to a plastic bag, do you think it's only political, but also or also cultural? Because you've traveled a lot, and as you said, you've seen agriculture with a new eye in different places. How did this add to your own vision of how you see agriculture?
Well, there are two types of structures. You have the formal structure and informal structure. So the political system is a formal structure, but then in the villages, we also have informal structures. So for instance, the way of doing agriculture is an informal structure. Either you do it like this, or please don't do it. And I understand that because it has been done like this for so many, for so long, you know, and it's like trial and error, trial and it's this traditional knowledge, you know, it's like, if you do like this, it will work. But actually, it's not true because, sorry, it's not true because myself, I was like this when I moved to other places and I was like, why are they doing like this? This is not the way it should be done, you know? I was a bit like that, even though I never had a garden myself. But then it took me really a many years and a lot of effort to integrate all this knowledge and to really learn, like, okay, there are other ways adapted to maybe to the climate, to the traditions of the place. Yeah, it's my traveling and seeing other practices, they have opened my eyes, but also my mind, you know. And permaculture practices, when I heard the first time about this, it was in Ireland, and I was like, wow, this looks like magic, you know. But then I was like, no, but I don't have time for studying this and doing this. And but in Norway, when we had this course, I was like, wow, this is amazing. So
sometimes I feel that agriculture can not only be studied, but, you know, if it's more about learning through practice than, you know, sitting in a class and studying about it. There's only so much you can study about it.
Yeah, but I also disagree with that, because in Spain, it was a political decision to make agricultural knowledge just as a kind of engineering course or program at the university, you know. So the traditional farming and agricultural knowledge got for the poor, you know, like, you cannot access a university, so you do this. And, well, they're still surviving based on this knowledge. It's not that bad. But the problem is that because the imposition of an industrial agriculture was so big in Spain that slowly the farmers and the peasants, they started using chemicals. So now they have normalized this, the use. So it's very complex, this scenario, because you have many things coexisting with each other. But in other countries, like in the Netherlands, and they have prioritized, or they have decided that agriculture is not an engineering program. It's something different. And they combine the theory with the practice. And I think that would be the best, actually, to combine theory with practice. And in Norway, there are also some programs where my friends, they study, some of my friends from this volunteering time, they became professional farmers, and they studied there. And it's not a university program. It's like a higher certificate. Now, slowly, these things are changing, and there are some university programs, I think, and in Norway they encourage women to do farming, you know. So when I was in Norway and these people is like, we need women as farmers, I was like, oh, I feel like, oh, so I'm welcome to become a farmer. So for me it's like, oh, cool. But then when I come back to my place, it's like, actually, it's not good to be a farmer or a peasant because it's just like non-existent. It's, they are extinct, actually, but it's a political decision to make this going extinct. And I don't think it's the way.
I think to a certain extent, institutionalization of agriculture was done with the aspect of regulation or standardization in mind. At a time when food security was a problem, where they had to find a way to provide food for a growing population. So in that sense, a lot of countries, mostly countries in the more suitable climates, adopted an industrial form of agriculture. The Scandinavian countries, as you are saying, had an opportunity because of limited conditions to experiment whatever they had. I think that's a, that's my understanding of how it must have been. Although I cannot say for sure that that would be the case.
No, but I think in the Scandinavian countries, they prioritize, like they have a very good understanding of autonomy. So they want to be self-sufficient, but they know they can't. Because some fruits, they simply don't grow there.
Yeah.
But in Norway, they have this attitude like, okay, we must do what we can with what we can, with what we have.
Mm.
It is, it's something that Spain, it has so many resources, you know, like the climate, the everything is like good, nearly. Like the resources are there, but it's the opposite. It's like, let's do the worst with what we have. So, but it's just, I think historically when Spain did not participate in the Second World War, so we had a dictatorship at the time, and even though, it was our modernization period, but I don't know, I just think that during the war or post-war, because we had our own war, and people were struggling, but in the we had this say like the people in the villages, they had food, but the problem is that when most of your population is living in cities, when a crisis comes, then no one has the food. So they are ignoring this, and post-war period is like this expert in France said, is like when it's a post-war or a war situation, like the French president now is saying, oh, we are in a war. Okay, if when you are in a war against the virus or against anyone, you provide people or the citizens, you provide them with shelter and food. And during the war, that was a warranty. Like, okay, you have to make long queues and this and that. But the food, a bit like in Venezuela, I don't get me wrong, like it's not good there, but the government has said, okay, we provide food to these people, even though they're starving, but it is a governmental decision. The thing is that when the government is just, okay, we are in a crisis, but we don't guarantee you the food, you know, you just buy your food or whatever you want. And so most of the people is in the cities, so they have to buy the food because they cannot produce the food, but they don't have the money to buy the food. And then in the villages, you have no one producing the food. So I think that is a, like, it's just so ridiculous, you know, like, so the crisis can go forever or worse because the, everything is upside down. I don't know. It is.
I mean, in many ways, what you explain or describe about Spain is also the case in India, where we have so much diversity of soil and conditions. And we can grow so many variety of vegetables and fruits and so much produce, and yet we choose to do something that destroys soil nutrients. And we continue to do it even though there is an understanding that it is working against us. Something that I have encountered while in conversation with Lotus as well, who comes from Egypt. And I would love to know what's her take, because she has described it on some occasions, how the condition was with cotton farmers in Egypt.
Well, in Egypt, it's a little bit different because most of the land is desert. So the only land fertile to do agriculture on is along the River Nile. And this is basically almost only 3% of the whole land area of Egypt. And yeah, I think from my personal opinion, it kind of divides itself around the event of building the High Dam in Egypt, which is the biggest dam in the south. Because before building the dam, the agriculture cycle depended mainly on the Nile flood, on the river flood. And people waited for the flood to happen, bringing up all the good soil from the riverbed and laying it as simply as that on the land so that they start cultivating the land. In fact, there are studies that this cycle, this specific flood, was really good for the soil, was really good for the crops, and post dam, the soil fertility went down actually because, of course, it protected so many people from the dangers of flooding. But on the downside, it also didn't supply the soil with all the fertilizer, the natural fertilizers that used to come. There has also been a wave of industrializing agriculture. And unfortunately, there are also some corrupt cases and scandals where the politicians were involved in it. And the early time of the Republic, they were put into laws that farmers need to multi-crop. These laws and these standards used to be, protective for the land. And suddenly they were cancelled, as simple as that. So farmers at the beginning took advantage of this for early or short-term profit, but in the long term it destroyed most of the fertile lands, actually.
That's interesting because it looks like it's some kind of liberalization of how the farmers can practice. But it ended up acting against the framework of nature itself in the context of Egypt. And I think this is again, this comes back to the argument that Andrea also made, that education to a certain extent in agriculture is important so that we understand how to practice it, because institutionalization of farming is not the only thing, but it is also important that we observe how the land that we cultivate behaves, and we observe how its cycles function naturally, and we nurture it accordingly, which is what Andrea has also been coming back at again and again. What do you think, Andrea?
Well, for instance, how your organization is destroying this land and the Miti, what we call the Miti.
Yeah.
Not only big projects, like dam projects, like Lotus explained.
Yeah.
But it is the whole, let's say, this type of development called modernization, which is quite detrimental not only to the land but to the lives of people. And don't take me wrong, like a dam, it might have a lot of benefits, but for the local communities, as you have explained now, the long-term consequences are very damaging.
Yeah.
And there are many cases of this also in India, no, with these huge dams.
Yeah.
And but also, I think there is now this era of digitalization, which is even, I don't know if worse. But the thing is that now, if the agricultural and farming practices are becoming more and more digitalized. In Norway, when I was doing some fieldwork for a course in agriculture trends, I was very surprised that even not so big farmer, he had already digitalized the milk production of his farm. I was like, wow. So the thing now is that for doing farming or agriculture, what you have to be is a kind of IT engineer, you know.
This is a very interesting thing that I encountered recently. A friend of mine shared an article named Agriculture 4.0. And I am like, what the hell? Because I have heard of Industrial 4.0, which is basically automating everything in industry. And now they want to automate agriculture. For some reason, I just could not understand the concept of automating agriculture, because it's not something that you can automate. The cycles work in a certain way, and I don't know. I mean, I think I am still at a stage where I cannot really comment on it on a bigger scale, but there is a general intuitive understanding that this is not how it functions.
It's functioning, you know. They even put sensors into the animals, so they control everything. All the cycles are digital, so you can see, okay, this cow had a calf and now it's milking time. So this, everything is digitalized. It's our own selves as well, like with all these technologies, and you know, it's just measuring. And It's really creepy, because then, like, what I observed there is just, there is no physical contact between the farmer and the animal. It gets so cold. And then when the calf is separated from the mother, because they do separate. So the calf is so stressed. And you can see, because animals, they have emotions, and special, cows and like, mammifero? ¿Cómo es en inglés?
Mammals, you mean?
Mammals? ¿Es mammifero?
Yeah, mammals.
So, especially for mammals, that they have some strong emotional bonds with each other, you know? We are also mammals. And they separate these animals, then they separate them from the care provider, who is the farmer, you know, or the peasant, because when you interact with the animals, you share this relationship, you share your love with the animals. And this way it gets so cold. So I don't know the good consequences of this. And then we want to put this into agriculture also. Just digitalize, the plant will grow themselves. The thing is that the plants they can grow themselves with our help. But the thing is just like, it is a strategy. The strategy is reducing the numbers of people working in agriculture and increasing the numbers of people working in the high developed educational sector. So it is a strategy. It's GDP strategy for the nations to become wealthier. It's just that, but I think it is a bit too much, because if you consider that people in the villages are still struggling to have access to basic education, and then just the higher elites, these elites who have studied at a higher level and mastered the art of digital, they can produce the food. I am very scared about this.
I am scared too. But what do you think about the disconnect that would be encouraged when you introduce digitalization into agriculture? Do you think it causes some level of emotional dysfunctionality between humans and nature?
Well, I think that's already a reality for some humans, you know. Some humans are so disconnected from nature, like in the big, big cities, the people are scared of going out of the city because, you know, sorry for making a bit of publicity here, is a geographical thing to study, you know, like with geographers, we study the relationship between people and places. So the thing is, you are growing up, or you are, familiar with the environment, then taking you out of this environment, you will feel a lot of stuff. So, for instance, me, I'm from a mountain region, So for me, going to the flat region is boring. It's like, where are the mountains? But for people from a flat region, coming to a mountain area like this, the person feels scared. It's like, oh my God. Like a lot of maybe anxiety or like a lot of things. So for people living in the cities, it's similar. Even though they are not real mountains, they feel protected. They feel like this. So when they go out into the nature, they feel like scared or panic. So, but it's just this emotional reaction. So the thing is that if this urbanization trend continues, and it's not only living in cities, but it's living in our computers, living in our virtual digital world, you know, that it can have some positive aspects. Like we can be doing this podcast thanks to technology. I don't say it's a bad thing, but for instance, if the people in the big cities, I don't say small cities because they are connected to villages as we mentioned, but in the big cities, if they don't have any interaction with nature, that is a big risk. So it is very important that kids in the big cities go to natures, go to villages and have these experiences. Me, I couldn't live in the village every day because there are no school. Well, there are schools, but sometimes there are no high schools, there are no universities. So I don't, well, that is another challenge and discussion. But so in some parts of our life, we have to live in cities. And that is kind of compulsory if you want to be highly educated. But it is so important actually to spend the first years of life in the right environment. There are studies about this, about how a child, for instance, just like in a good family or bad family, it makes a huge impact. If you live in a family where your parents are abusing you the whole day, you will grow in a certain way. If you are born in a loving family, you will develop as other individual. So that is the same with places. If you are growing up in a safe place with good relationship towards nature, then you can have a different development than someone who has never seen an animal and is scared and ignores where the food comes from. So I think we should, it's not black or white, but it's just having this knowledge for the children to experience this. And then they will grow up like loving this, because actually, tell me which child doesn't love to explore and to be free and to be with, you know, because in nature you are free. Like for us living in the village, we can go everywhere. There is no danger. Like, and you feel free. But if you are growing up in an apartment, like alone and, or, you know, close, then you don't experience this sense of freedom or this connection with nature.
That is true.
And not just children, I would say, adults as well, because there have been so many initiatives like urban gardens and terrace farming. Of course, these all have their limitations, but I bet even in big cities, there is a section of people that wish they have more access to, let's say, not countryside, but rather their own farming experience, you know? And I think alternative agriculture in this case is such a great field for this to explore, because Andrea, you haven't been always there around your piece of land that you experimented on, right? The Hügel you started and left and then came back and so on, right?
So no, I just put it, then I left, and now when I come back, I meet them again. You know, but it's like people. It's like meeting people. When you travel, then you come back, you meet your friends. So no, but it's true, because you see the progress, you see the plant growing. It's a living creature somehow.
It is.
So we cannot just imagine now they want to patent all the seeds. That's the most stupid thing and absurd thing ever. They have life itself, you know, like, of course, if you modify them to kill their lives, okay, they are doing this for the business, but well, they are free to do this, but nature would survive, we live without humans, but humans, we don't live without nature.
That is true.
It is just relationship, you know, and also when I went to France and planted the potatoes, now I come back among my friends and sending me the pictures of the potatoes. And I feel like, oh, I wish I'm there, you know, just with them, eating them, of course. But yeah, and the feeling of even though I'm here, I did something there and the people are so happy, you know, like they are just so thankful, like, oh, we're so happy you taught us to plant potatoes. I was like, like you, and they didn't know because they're from city.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm not an expert. I told them, it's like, I'm sorry, I'm not an expert. I never did this myself. It was the first time planting potatoes. But of course, I helped this gardener. I saw this garden, like just by observation. But I never led anything like this. So I was the leader there. I was like, oh my God. And also they were so eager to learn and they were asking me questions. And I was like, okay. But I'm so happy we succeeded with the potatoes because then they can. But next time these people, they can do themselves, you know.
Yeah.
They are self-sufficient. Now they know how to do and they will do. But if you don't know how to do this, you are ignorant. So this knowledge, you know, is just so simple and to be shared and to. I don't know.
Yeah, to a certain extent, it makes you feel free. You have this freedom to experiment, to do your own thing. And on that note, I would like to come to the end of this podcast. We discussed a lot of things in this episode, ranging from Andrea's experience in agriculture, how she dabbled with a lot of techniques, her experiences in various countries and various backgrounds with people. Her anecdotes are so interesting, which obviously comes from a certain life experience. We also discussed certain things, which I think would be very interesting topics to write about in our future blogs, like urbanization and digitalization of agriculture. Thank you, Andrea, for joining us from Spain and sharing your experiences.
Find the link to Andrea's blog post in the episode description. If you enjoyed this conversation, please like this episode, share it, and send us your comments below. Thanks again, and see you next time.
See you next time.